Welcome to Witchlit, a place to talk about the craft of writing and writing the craft. I'm your host, Victoria Rashke, author, publisher, witch, and nosy Scorpio. Witchlit is brought to you by Thousand Volt Press, a family-owned independent publisher established to produce the books we want to see in the world. Titles including Changing Paths by Yvonne Abreu, Conjuring the Commonplace by Lane Fuller and Corey Thomas Hutchison, A Death in the Dry River by Lisa Allen Agostini, and my most recent book, Verona Green, can be purchased directly from thousandvoltpress.com or wherever you buy books. You can also support the show by buying us a cup of coffee at ko-fi.com/witchlitpodcast. Marshall is a practicing traditional folkloric witch living in Texas. He is the author of Cunning Words, A Grimoire of Tales and Magic, and most recently, The Red Mother, Cunning Words Collection 2. You can also listen to him talk magic and folklore on his podcast, Southern Bramble, a podcast of Crooked Ways. Marshall, the Witch of Southern Light, welcome back to Witchlit.
Hi, thank you so much for having me. I'm so happy to be here.
I think this is officially your third appearance, so you might have been the person who's been on the show the most.
It's an honor. Where's my jacket? Or do I need to wait like two more times for that? Five-timers jacket.
Yeah, I'm going to have to work on the five-timers jacket.
That's okay. I'll have to write more books.
There you go. Well, there we go. Hopefully that's happening. So you know, because you've been on the show before, that our first question for everybody is why write? So to mix it up a little bit, I wanted to be more specific and like, why write this book now? So why write The Red Mother now?
You know, I actually started writing this immediately after finishing Cunning Words. For me, there was no really break between the two. It was this constant flow. Cunning Words is my first book, and it still feels kind of like a miracle to me that it exists, because I never thought, and I don't mean this as like a put down, I don't know how to say this any other way. I don't think anyone else in my life thought I was kind of capable of writing a book too. And maybe I kind of believed that until day by day, pages came together and I wrote them, you know, as individual stories. And as we talked about last time, my book is narrative magic. It teaches witchcraft through the power of storytelling. And The Red Mother was something that was so prevalent to me while writing Cunning Words, that she was the first one that I really felt like I had to immediately continue going with telling these stories. And her stories were the ones that seemed to speak to me the most from the very, very beginning. Mm-hmm. She wasn't actually the first one I wrote. I wrote Our Mother in Green first. And I don't know what happened when I got into writing about The Red Mother. I just felt like the world needed to know them, and they needed to know them fast, because I didn't want the first to get stale. I wanted people to be hungry for more before, you know, making that hunger phase fast, and we're just like, oh, I'm fine now. But I also really wanted to draw attention to some of her origins. We only got to meet her in midlife in Cunning Words. She kind of popped up when people needed her, and sometimes she'd make you a trade and she'd help you. But I was so hungry for her stories, her origins, where she came from, what were her younger years? How did she come to be this magical witch? And her inspiration being Old Mother Redcap, a famous collective of figures from England. And actually, there was a whole nother one that ended up popping up in Appalachia, which has another side story, which is interesting. But she was this kind of well-known figure who was this charmer who wore a little red cap on, and it became a familiar phrase to use for a lot of charmers, cunning women, alewives, whatnot. And she always wore some sort of, I mean, she may not have continuously wore something red after this first name dwelled, but a head covering that was red, a cape, a shawl. It was a popular folk name for these women. And I don't think we know a lot of their stories. So I wanted to put those stories out there. I wanted people to kind of get that familiarity with the archetype of the cunning woman, the cunning person, I should say, because mm-hmm. anyone could step into these shoes.
Yeah. Oh, I love that. And I did reading this one, like I enjoyed the first one so much. And there's so much of you in that book.
Definitely.
And then reading this one, like those stories and your author notes, like it just felt like even more of you, like just kind of like opening up your story as you opened up hers. And I don't know, it just really, I was trying to like be judicious with my sleep and I wound up staying up way too late to finish reading because I was just so engaged in like kind of you telling the story, the way you told the story and then your author notes. And I think we talked about this last time that like a lot of traditional publishers probably would have said no to the author notes.
Yeah.
And I think they add so much to those stories.
Absolutely. And you know, we as magical practitioners, which is occultists, however you identify in this community, this grand community, you know, we have all these famous published grimoires from the past. But there's something else. I was actually listening to another podcast all about magicians' notebooks. What magic is this? And it's magicians' workbooks. That's what it is. Mm-hmm. I was interviewing Alexander Cummins. And these workbooks are full of notes and margins of, I tried this from this grimoire, this ceremony, mm-hmm. this seal. This is how I prepare myself. It didn't work, so I changed this. We actually get to start seeing the way their lives ended up influencing their magic. Mm-hmm. We read about these 16th, 17th, 18th century grimoires. But if we don't know the political things that were happening when these were written, if you didn't know that the blue Bibliothèque Bleue time period was such a boom because the printing press became much more prevalent over in France, if you didn't know that, you know, this book that was printed in the 1800s claims to be written in the 1400s, but wasn't, you don't know the type of climate, the people who were hungry mm-hmm. for what they're hungry for, what they were experiencing. You know, why certain grimoires are all about healing and why certain ones are all about your wrath and why certain ones are all about treasure hunting, because you won't yeah. know what people's motivations were at mm-hmm. that time period. And the author's notes were a really important thing to me because it really showed the motivations behind certain stories, behind certain acts of mm-hmm. magic. What was happening at this point in time? If people read this book 100 years from now, they're going to be like, oh my God. They were taking away children from queer parents just because they were affirming. Like it was, this is something that people are going to look back in the past and know what influenced it at the time.
Yeah. No, and I think that is such an important point. Like even reading a book now, mm-hmm. if you don't know the author personally, like if you don't have a connection to them, you really can't know what lens they're writing from.
Absolutely.
And like every time somebody picks up a book, you're reading it, you're reading their words, but you're reading it through your lens and your context. And so I think giving that to a reader is a gift that a lot of people just don't get. So
it's like, you know, when you watch a movie or read a book and like your friends are watching it with you and they're like, oh my God, he's so dreamy. And I'm like, are we watching the same person? He's toxic. He's toxic AF.
Yeah. Oh yeah, exactly. Oh. So one of the other things I was thinking, I was just reading the book and I was like, so now I want the green mother and the black mother.
Well,
are you in?
I will be cagey with this response at this time, but I will say this is part of a collection mm-hmm. and there's definitely more to come. The same way this book was slightly different from the first book, while it mm-hmm. did involve stories, there was a different sort of theme to it. Mm-hmm. Each book in the full collection will definitely have different themes and mm-hmm. and storytelling devices. But I am excited to see what the future comes for this collection.
Yeah, me too. And I just wanted to say, like one of the things I really noticed is like, I mean, it's interesting to like see you grow as an author. Like I could just see the growth from the first book, but your artwork has also grown too.
Thank you.
Which I just thought was really fun to get to kind of experience that from book to book.
Thank you. That means a lot to me. You know, I wrote this book about the witch's journey and when you read it, it feels like it's written kind of like yesteryear, but there's no specific year given. There's no time. Right. It just does.
Yeah, I kind of love that older. About it. Yeah.
I want it to be very ambiguous. But one of the things that was always so inspiring for me throughout the history of my visual love of witchcraft is ancient woodcuts, medieval woodcuts, woodcuts of witches through the witch trials, mm-hmm. woodcuts of what they believed witches were doing. You know, you have the meat flying to the Sabbath, you have feeding your frog familiars, you have the famous one with the three witches with the animal heads are flying on a broom. Mm-hmm. You have all of these influential things that have made their way literally into our media. You know, it was in the background mm-hmm. of the opening number of The Craft. We see these in a lot of spell books being used mm-hmm. in movies and TV shows. We even have it on the end credits of Agatha All Along right now.
I was going to say, yeah, it's showing up like right now.
So these have been super pervasive throughout the history of witchcraft. And I really wanted my art to have the same feel. I wanted it to invoke those same feelings. Mm-hmm. And I did a lot of practicing creating I did Procreate. So I did everything by hand, but electronically on my iPad. And it was a really cool experience figuring out the process of making a piece of art that it evoked that feeling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, and it does. Yeah. And
you get to see throughout this book, this witch who's growing into her powers, mm-hmm. who's made pacts, who is experimenting with her book of magic that was gifted to her, who is sometimes helping people along the way, sometimes not being so helpful, purposely, you know, sometimes going out of her
helpful
way to
in a way
be not so helpful.
To teach them a lesson.
Yeah, some people get lessons taught to them, and some people don't get the opportunity to learn the lesson by the end. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we have this history of mythology and fairy tales teaching lessons, whether that's to children or to inform an entire spiritual practice. And that came through in the stories for me in the grimoire section, which has all the magic listed, the spirits to contact, but also within the art itself, because mm-hmm. you saw this journey through the art from the very beginning all the way into the end. And even in the opening, on the opening page and the title page, you know, you see her all wrapped and shrouded in her red shroud, right? But mm-hmm. then the very end, there is a piece of artwork that goes to the poem that shows it being totally unraveled and being free and finding sovereignty. Mm-hmm. And there's a little Easter in the back for people who may or may not have seen it.
Yeah. And for listeners, Marshall is holding up the gorgeous hard copy edition. So.
I have to admit, it is really pretty.
It is really pretty. I mean, having read it as a PDF, I was like, oh, purchases may have to be made. So I guess, you know, one of the things I wanted to talk to you too, so this is your second book. Mm-hmm. And so you've kind of been through that whole like cycle of write, publish, deal with all the aftermath and flogging it and all that. So what did you feel like you learned from the first time that you did differently this time?
To enjoy it a little bit more. A couple things that I learned, that honestly, going through the self-publishing process was a big learning curve the first time. It did not feel that way the second time. I felt like I had a lot more control over what was going to happen, how to go about it, making sure I've got the margins right, downloading everything correctly. That one was really, really helpful. But writing was a little bit different because the first book was very exploratory for me. And this one was a little bit more on mission. Mm-hmm. And I think that's also why I feel like I've wanted to take some more time to celebrate this time. I'm not rushing to put out the next collection in the collection. Mm-hmm. I should say I am writing it, but I'm being very slow and methodical with it.
Yeah.
And I feel like I was very, very excited the first time around. And then I just really kind of wanted to rush in to do it more. But now I'm kind of realizing that there is a lot more of a joy and taking a moment for the calmness mm-hmm. and really focusing on the Red Mother and letting people hear about it, letting them know about it. Mm-hmm. I think when it comes to occult publishing, we're always kind of, I know this is kind of silly, but ever since I was a kid, I always wanted that kind of more the ancient spell book, that one you hide finding in a basement and when you mm-hmm. move into an old New England home. And there's something about magic taught through song, through story, that sticks with you a little bit more. Mm-hmm. And I have to admit, writing this has stuck with me a little bit harder, not necessarily than the first one, but I still feel like I am swimming in the pool of the Red Mother right now. Mm-hmm. I'm not ready to hop out just yet. I'm really exploring a lot of the magic. I've done obviously a lot of magic that's in here.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I'm having fun making it my own as I encourage people who work with this to adapt it to your landscape, to make it your own, to follow these things. But a lot of the conjurations do involve, you got to use your noodle here. I mean, you know, the conjurations require three offerings of flora, mm-hmm, that correspond and support and aid your ultimate goal and aim. So, you know, you can get out your old list of correspondences, but I think that there is a level of cunning nature of to the witch, mm-hmm, who understands what that means to go outside and say, I'm looking for protection. I'm going to take an acorn from this mighty oak at my corner of the crossroads, who's been here for 100 years, who has deep roots, roots that literally uproot things that get in its way. I think there is a magic in making that connection on your own. And I want people to take that opportunity to, mm-hmm, to think about that.
Yeah, that was one of the things I really enjoyed about the workings in the book, is that idea of this is the framework, but you really have to supply this piece.
Yeah.
And it's funny you say that about correspondences. I've been doing a lot of research, especially around herbs and looking at, you know, like Dioscorides and Gerard and like all of the, you know, like from Greece to the Middle Ages and early modern, and they don't agree on anything.
No.
So like you can get your list of correspondences, but it's someone else's interpretation. It always is. And I'm seeing it even at more now, looking at all these, you know, ancient to very old books. And I was like, yeah, it's really working with your plant ally, or, you know, like you said, what's in your backyard, mm-hmm, to really understand what those mean to your magic.
And, you know, I have a friend who is a practicing folk witch, and they work with three plant spirits. That's it. Mm-hmm. They live in a place where these are their prevalent relationships. These are the three plants they work with. And that's that. They have, mm-hmm, no interest in branching out anymore, and they've got no instruction to. So
yeah,
that's one of those things where I can totally see how they would adapt this work directly with their own landscape.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah. I love that. It's funny. I am in California, and we have some non-native crepe myrtle trees planted in our backyard. And every when they bloomed this summer, I thought of you because we talked about it last time.
Are they white or bright pink?
They are they're not like the deep fuchsia pink. They're kind of a lighter pink.
Oh, how perfect.
Yeah. And they're really pretty, and they haven't completely murdered them. I really dislike a lot of the crepe myrtles I see out here have been crepe murdered. But these, they're kind of letting have their natural shape to some extent. So I appreciate that. But it's just so funny when we moved here, that like there's a magnolia tree in our front yard and these two crepe myrtles in the back. And I was like,
you're describing my entire.
Yeah. And I'm in San Jose, California. And I was like, unfortunately, the magnolia has been crepe murdered, but they just are not street trees, and they plant them out here as street trees.
Yeah.
And it's just an odd kind of thing. But I was like, oh, get this Southern girl renting this house with all these Southern trees outside. But I think it really is like, I would have not thought to work with a magnolia tree in California, but literally there's one in front of my house.
Yeah, absolutely.
That needs love and attention.
Absolutely. So, I think there's a charm in cunning words that involves using a young magnolia pine cone, mm-hmm, and a glamour charm for youth and beauty.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, it's just, I love that you've like not only like kind of made, like you said, made people use your noodle, but also given space to really make the work you're doing applicable wherever people are.
Mm-hmm. I think that's really
kind of
important.
Like, it's not set in a time or place, really.
Absolutely. The spirits are so interesting too, when you kind of apply what you just said to that, because they really attach to your intention. Mm-hmm. If that makes sense, and you stitch them together with specific acts or specific things that are coming together for this conjuration. And because it involves your local flora, because it involves your specific attention, because it's not something that's like, you must stand at this mountain at this time under these stars. you get to take it to your own altar, take it to your own crossroads, take it to your own cemetery, if you will. Like, you take it to your own woods. You really can personalize this magic, and it's meant to be personalized.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I think on some level that has become kind of a weird sticking point, because I mean, American folkloric magic and American traditional witchcraft or Wicca, it all looks back across the Atlantic, right?
Sure. Yeah.
And a lot of those plants we don't have here. I mean, a lot of them they brought, we know, our colonizers brought when they came, but you know, a lot of them, they don't grow like in parts of like where you are or where I am, they don't necessarily even grow here. So it's so important to me to kind of, even going back to that workbook, like the magician's workbook idea, things are not going to work the same. So you have to experiment. You have to see what works where you are and with the land spirits you're working with or the plant spirits you're working with. And I think it just opens that up. And I just appreciate that about your work.
Well, thank you.
But it's just been interesting to kind of think about this. And I mean, I think we talked about this a little bit last time too, about you kind of have this very public witch persona because of your time on TikTok and in social media. And so you have a following that comes with that when you're publishing. But does that make things more fraught in a way too? Like when you put something out, do you feel like more eyes are on you?
That's a good question. I do think about that sometimes, but not too often. So here's, I don't think about that as, let me rephrase. The weight that stands on me when I think about the amount of people who are seeing my work every day, who I'm going to expose what I say to, it makes me think a lot about what I say. Mm-hmm. And the thing is I don't think, I think that can be a heavy burden, but I think it's one that I need to take responsibility for, if that makes sense. I'm not going to say Spider-Man lines here, but I mean, there is a responsibility of how I use my platform. We were talking about, you know, people using their platforms either to spread misinformation or, you know, not just misinformation, but opinions that are ignorant of information. Mm-hmm. I think a lot about the captions that I write in my Instagram posts. I think a lot about the way that I reply to people. So I'm like, listen, I'm a really jokey person and I have a dark sense of humor and I'm very sarcastic sometimes. So the amount of time that I'm reading someone's tweet or like thread and I'm just like, oh my gosh, yes. I'm going to write something back that's silly and stupid. And I'm like, wait, how could that be misread? What if that comes across as this? Oh, I don't mean that intention. I'm being sarcastic, but at the same time, if they don't know that, there's no sarcasm font here.
Yeah.
So I think about that a lot. And when I put a book out, my second book to put out, I really definitely go into a vulnerable place where I truly hope everyone resonates with it. But I also understand not everyone will. Mm-hmm. And I kind of try to remind myself on that a regular basis. Not everything is for everyone. And I totally have gotten a lot more comfortable in the last year recognizing that it is okay if I'm not for you.
Yeah, I think that's a valuable lesson as a public person of any kind. that you're just not for everybody. And
our words will matter. So we need to make sure that if we're going to say something that means something, that we've put enough work behind making sure that we're speaking either in a fact-based place or this is my opinion. And I guess you don't have to be open to changing it, but I do try to listen to others. I think that's a huge part of what makes a community. Is not someone standing at the top shouting down at people, but be willing to listen to other people, be willing to listen to dissenting opinions. I mean, this is just a general thing that I shouldn't have to say, but I feel like new facts should inform or change your opinions if you didn't know them before. But apparently that's a really controversial thing to say.
I mean, it's not just true in witchcraft, unfortunately.
Yeah, exactly. Like, the amount of times I've had conversations with my dad, I'm like, Dad, that's not true. Look, here's this article showing this. Here is the statistics of such and such.
Yeah.
And he would be like, oh, okay. But his opinion won't change.
Yeah. Well, and it's kind of like, it's funny you say like that anecdote, because when I was thinking about this, like, you know, with climate change and with the pandemic and all, you know, like suddenly everyone was a climatologist and a virologist or epidemiologist.
Yeah.
And most of us are dealing with science that we learned in junior high and high school and haven't kept up with.
The closest thing is YouTube. We got doctors of YouTube.
Yeah. And so for me, like, that's 30 years since I've had like a current science class. I mean, thankfully I have friends who are scientists who love nothing more than informing us. So it's been really helpful, but
that's always helpful.
Yeah. But I'm just like, you know, there's so much that's happened in 30 years that I wasn't taking classes. You know, I wasn't keeping up with, you know, I wasn't reading Scientific American. I wasn't reading Nature, you know, or whatever. And so I think it's kind of the same thing with witchcraft. Like there are academic things happening in the occult world. And I don't think you have to keep up with those. I mean, I think if your practice doesn't involve that, that's fine. But maybe don't prognosticate about it on social media.
Yeah.
If you don't read that stuff. So yeah, it's just a weird existence. And like, I want, you know, like, I don't want to be that person shouting down to everybody else.
No,
I'm sure I would say something stupid.
And I have said stupid things, and I've been grateful enough to have people tell me in my comments or message me saying like, hey, actually, you may not have known this, but such and such. And then they'll provide me with some information I didn't know before. I'll take down a post. I'll apologize for a post. Mm-hmm. I will absolutely take ownership.
Yeah.
But having that voice itself, I'm lucky enough to have a large following. It's a privilege. Period.
Yeah.
But I think having that privilege comes with a responsibility and making sure I'm aware of what I say.
Yeah, I think so too. And I mean, mine is much smaller. But like, it's even like, it's still at the point now where it's like, oh, and I've heard someone talk about it in the way, like, you know, like if you said something or if you like went somewhere and you read a poem out loud and 10 people showed up, that would feel like a lot. And basically, if you post and you have 2,000 followers, imagine what 2,000 people look like in a room.
Yeah.
And when you're talking multiple thousands of people, like that's kind of hard for us to wrap human brains around a little bit.
It really is. Because it's all up in the cloud.
Mm-hmm.
It's all out of our sight.
Yeah. It's not people in a stadium.
Exactly. Exactly.
No, for some people, that's that many people. I mean,
so if someone wants to get on the stadium and talk about my book, I support you.
Yes, go do that. 100%.
I'm just waiting for the day that Taylor Swift is like, have y'all read Cunning Words?
I love the idea of occult stadium shows.
Wouldn't that be great? Oh my gosh.
What a different world that would be. What a different world that would be. Oh, yeah. So I'm curious.
Please.
Since you are writing at your leisure now,
yes,
like, what are you doing to feed your creative well in this kind of in between time?
Right.
I mean, I
now,
know you're watching Agatha all along because you've posted great things about it.
Effing religiously. Oh my gosh. I've been making jewelry.
Oh wow.
Yeah, I like to make jewelry. I've been on a very big pearl phase lately where I buy cultured freshwater pearls, and I've been making them for all my friends, my family, for birthdays, for Christmas from the past. Making my own. I don't have it close by. I just recently made my own Agatha Three Graces pendant.
Oh, I saw you did a post about it. I saw it.
Yes. Yeah. It was really cool. And I started realizing how much I enjoy it. And you know, pearls connect back to Aphrodite or Venus. It connects back to the story of her bursting from the shell, being born from the sea. Mm-hmm. I thought it was perfect for the Three Graces pendant because the Three Graces are the handmaids of Aphrodite. And writing has taken a slight backseat right now. I think it's kind of meant to be, let me focus on what I've created for a little while instead of rushing on to create something new, which goes back to what we were talking about. I'm still swimming in the Red Mother pool. I'm still absorbing. Honestly, like the amount of times that I proofread this or self-edited it before my editor, after my editor, after my editor the second time, there were times where I still kind of had to take a moment and absorb some of the stories that I wrote because Some of them I wrote a year ago. Mm-hmm. And as I wrote it, I wrote everything out of order. Once I put them all together, it seemed a lot more clear the order in which these things should go. And to this day, I still sometimes will find myself thinking about that story and kind of having a new little epiphany, finding mm-hmm. out this thing that influenced me that I didn't even know when I wrote it. Working some of this magic, I really do see her as the mentor, as the spirit of the cunning folk, and mm-hmm. the charms that she's taught me are something that I am actively now working, not only in my own life, but in my friends' lives, who they sometimes come to me and ask for guidance on something. Mm-hmm. I've been focusing a lot more on that lately.
Yeah. No, I like that. I feel like you know this because you've published two books, that there is this kind of like up and down roller coaster cycle that happens with writing and publishing and
yes,
blogging and all of the stuff that comes with that. And I think it's pretty easy to just kind of get lost in that. Like, you know, you're done writing, it's out. And like, even more so probably for people who are traditionally published, because that cycle is so long between yeah. when you're finished with the book and when it actually hits the shelves, and then you have to promote it. And there's like this weird down period where you're already on to the next project and then you have to backtrack in your yeah. brain. So I think that, you know, is one of the nice things about self-publishing, is that cycle is much tighter than it is with traditional publishing. But
yeah, I mean, I really do get to write when I feel inspired and take time off when I'm not feeling that right now. Mm-hmm. There were multiple times where mid story, I would be like, I'm struggling. I'm going to stop. Mm-hmm. It's time to stop now.
Yeah.
And when it really hits me again, I'll pick it right back up. And it's so crazy the way it'll hit. And then there will be just like day after day after day after day, it flows. And then that flow sort of stops. I'm again, privileged to have the freedom to do that. Writing mm-hmm. is not my full-time job.
Yeah.
I do it in my free time. All the artwork was in my free time. So yeah. I've been grateful for that.
Yeah. I had a question and it left.
It's a shame when that happens.
It's a shame when that happens. But I was just thinking about, you say, you know, it's not your full-time job, you're doing something else. But like, how do you, like, when you are on, like, I'm writing now and you're in it, like, how do you make space? I mean, I know we talked about last time that you write at the gym.
On the elliptical. At the gym yeah. on the elliptical.
Yeah.
How do I make space for the rest of my life?
Yeah. I mean, that's a lot to balance a full-time job and writing and the artwork yeah. and being your own publisher and just living your life in the middle of all that.
There were times where there wasn't a lot of space. Like, there were times where I felt very, no, I can't do this. I can't, I have to go to the gym this morning so I can write this morning. I have more to say and I'm excited about it. The thing was, is when I was in that flow state, when I was excited about it, it didn't feel like work. It actually felt like I was creating something. I was mm-hmm. creating something. That didn't drain me. That deeply encouraged me. It was kind of like mm-hmm. fanning the flame. In fact, this past weekend, I was at the gym. I was on the elliptical and I did a whole hour before it went off on its own, because I was really into what I was writing. Mm-hmm. It was taking me to a whole nother place and I kind of forgot that I was there. And then when I finished that section that I was working on and when that was done, I haven't been itching to do it again just yet. Mm-hmm. And between that time period, I have a lot of downtime.
Yeah.
So maybe that's why I need a lot of downtime to recover from the really busy times and vice versa.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think that's a bad thing. I mean, I've talked with lots of other folks on the show that, you know, there is this idea that writers write every day and you have to have the schedule and blah, blah, blah. And like, nobody's life is really like that.
Yeah. I mean, there might be people who really thrive in that environment, but at the same time, I don't. And yeah. so if you do,
intervenes.
Good for you.
Even if life you do intervenes. Thrive in that environment, life intervenes.
Absolutely. So. I watch a lot of Murder, She Wrote. Life intervenes.
Yeah. I watched a lot of Murder, She Wrote. It's been a while, but I was doing this like huge embroidery project that I'm still kind of working on, but I have kind of set it aside for a little bit. But yeah, I would watch Murder, She Wrote. And what is it about that show, his background? It's really weird.
I love it. Well, Angela Lansbury. I mean, Angela Lansbury is just... Oh. She's an icon.
Very much so. Eglantine Price, man.
Oh, yeah.
She's one of my like personal witches.
Absolutely.
Like nerdy into books. That would be me. That would totally be me. I remembered partly what I was going to ask you about. One of the things I love about this book.
Yes, please.
Because I think a lot of people who are maybe more on the folkloric side of witchcraft, but have like grimoire curiousness.
Yeah.
Like is stepping into that world of like goetic spirits and stuff and the seals and all that can feel really overwhelming. Like it, a lot of those books are dense and there's no handholding. Sometimes there's not even a good translation. And then you have kind of created this whole system that mirrors that, but is very much yours.
Yeah. You know, creating these spirits, because I want to make it very clear, these are created spirits. And there's a whole chapter on literally the making of these spirits. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people sometimes get really hung up on older grimoires with lots of seals and goetic spirits. You know, what are you summoning? What do you have to offer it? These circles drawn on the floor, these mirrors, these 40 days of purifying. This is a lot of stuff and a lot of conjurations. And what I wanted to do was kind of get down to the back to the weaving of magic that we as witches create. I wanted to get back into understanding the power source that I'm compacting with to work with this magic so I can weave this magic. A whole lot of the story is about spinning thread, about weaving, about reweaving the threads of fate, about tying knots in the threads of fate, the blanket of destiny. Like there is a lot of weaving going on in this, and it's the same with our magic. So there is a compendium of 13 spirits, which you actually get to read her conjure in multiple stories. So you get to see some adaptations of these conjurations. You get to see some mistakes people make when you don't do the conjuration with some of the things that are truly necessary versus how you can adapt them. You get to see the outcomes of what happens with them. But these spirits are created by taking their major intention behind them: healing, protection, inspiration, courage, justice, and using all of the strokes from those letters to create a symbol that becomes that spirit's name. That symbol is their calling card. It's their conjuring name. And there's a separate section in there called Red Inscriptions, which we can go into if you want, but at the same time, they are a magical alphabet that calls upon the power of past witches, calls upon the power of those whose lives were too short. It's a necromantic art working with these inscriptions, and their actual names are written in the inscriptions around them. So you have this weaving together of multiple magics to build this servitor who is conjured, for better lack of words, to do your bidding, you know, to go forth and bring out your specific intention, the statement, your desire into the world. And it's a very specific, almost somewhat mathematical system of building these spirits with a lot of personal wiggle room.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I do love that you talk about, like, it is kind of a blend of like that kind of Solomonic seal magic, but also with chaos magic.
Yes. Chaos magic. With acts of necromancy, and the thing about the seals that I think gets to me is a lot of people have different types of hangups about working with either Christian prayers or Abrahamic prayers. Some people don't know how to work with certain planetary seals. Some of the translations make it feel like, wait, these seem like they do the same thing, or do you have to do this one and this one? And I feel like it becomes such a large system of ceremonial magic that, honestly, that ceremonial magic as a large whole really isn't deep into my wheelhouse. I'm really in the dirt. I'm really into the art, the craft of witchcraft. And these spirits, as a witch's created being, feels much more home to me. These feel like my spirits. These feel like something that not only can I work with, I understand why they exist. Does that make sense?
Oh no, totally. Totally makes sense. Yeah. And I was thinking, like, So you have created these spirits and their seals and told their stories to some extent with how the Red Mother uses them. So what have you thought about what that means, like in your own work now that other people will also be working with them?
And they're going to bring a lot of their own intention to it too. Mm-hmm. The seals themselves are basically like I said, you're called the spirit's calling mm-hmm. card. But when you stitch and weave this spirit together with these multiple forms of magic, it's your craft you're weaving into it. It's not that I want to encourage people to change these procedures in any way, but that's where this local adaptation comes in. Mm-hmm. This is the opportunity for people to work with spirit conjuration in a way that just, I don't want to say this any other way, it feels to me like I'm working an act of witchcraft and not working an act of divine intervention, ceremonial magic. There is a lot of, I command this spirit by the power of this God's name, who I've done these prayers for. That's not really what it's about. There's no weapon. There's no swords. There's not really any knives in this. You can grab one around if you want, but that's not what they're, that's not really what they're for.
Yeah. You don't have to conjure 27 tools to then conjure the
exactly.
spirit.
Exactly. And it's all about working with a cauldron, working with a few simple mm-hmm. ingredients, dirt from the crossroads, a fistful of sea salt, red fire or red spirits, which has a story that teaches you how to create it, where it comes from. Mm-hmm. So you understand all of these things are coming together for the conjuration of the spirit that you're making. And I think a lot of people got lost during the huge egregore phase. And then, for lack of better words, the tulpa phase of I'm creating a thought form and that's going to do my bidding. And that's cool. I love it. That's great. I think sometimes we get really lost in the science of the creation and not the magic of the creation, which is really why I wanted to focus on the conjuring in a cauldron and using a specific set of symbols to do that. Because this is something we as witches, I think, really have an affinity for when it comes to conjuring.
Yeah. And do you think that is one of the big differences between witchcraft and ceremonial magic? And you kind of talked about, you know, like there is this like spirit bothering to get them to do your work.
Yeah.
For you. And it's kind of one of the things that I've always found a little off-putting about like goetic magic and kind of Solomonic magic. It's like, I would not want someone to do something for me that I made them do in that way. Like, and, does that and benefit
need,
me?
Yeah. And I don't need to. There are so many other ways to go about this.
Yeah. Yeah. Like the threatening doesn't really, never really worked for me.
Like, when someone threatens me, I promise you, I don't feel more obliged.
Exactly. And I think there's also just like, and I think this is just, kind of goes back to what we were talking about like how things change and grow and mm-hmm. like our perception changes over time. Like there's like this weird element, maybe not even weird. There is an element of enslavement in that practice.
Yeah.
That I'm really deeply uncomfortable with, especially when we're talking about spirits of dead humans. Mm-hmm. Like I feel deeply uncomfortable about that.
And, you know, that goes back to our earlier discussion about understanding the political times of something when something was written.
Yeah.
So when we think back to the actual, like, you know, Levikia Solomonis, when we think about the Key of Solomon, mm-hmm. when we think about the Lesser Key of Solomon with this enslavement of demons, we're also thinking about a time period where Christianity was super prevalent. Demons mm-hmm. were bad. Punishing demons into doing your thing was kind of like not if you ask a clergy, right? They're not going to mm-hmm. say it's okay, but that's going to take on a whole connotation of understanding the prevalence of God and the church and its thumb that was on all of our necks as people who might be doing magic, the way in which it was totally okay to do these because these were bad guys. The mindset of colonialism in the first place is, if you want to go back to medieval years and the way in which the class and hierarchy system of how little kings thought of peasants, mm-hmm. you know, we can apply that to the time period and understand why people thought this was totally normal when it comes to magic.
Yeah.
Not even to mention the fact that it was written by kind of ripping off Jewish magic from centuries before, mm-hmm. not even real Jewish magic.
Like perceived.
But perceived from yeah. a Christian perspective.
Yeah.
So when we understand that and apply to that work, I can theoretically understand why it's written that way. Mm-hmm. The thing is we don't live in that time period anymore.
Nope.
We don't live in that political climate to a degree. We as a lot of witches being inspired by this history, have the ability to adapt it to a modern time. We now have aspects of chaos magic. We have folklore. We have new stories that are literally mm-hmm. being written, some by me. We have this ability to really kind of bring our magic forward and start thinking about how we're weaving it into the world a little bit more. Listen, I'm not sitting here saying you have to do all love and light and niceness, but how we can do it with a little bit more efficiency without a little, with a lot less enslavement.
Yeah, it's more cooperation.
Yeah, there's a lot of cooperation going on. There's a lot of recognition of nature, of offerings, of working with. I mean, mm-hmm. some of these, you know, involve giving a drop of blood as payment or as a life force. The three spirits of Flora for the 13 conjurings in the back are offerings to not only give this spirit, but to aid it in its journey, to guide it with its collection of correspondences or virtues. There's a reason all these things come together for it. And like I said, there's a chapter that helps explain that so people understand it. And I think if you're a witch who's anything like me, I love trying to understand something, the magic mm-hmm. of something, the whys yeah. of something. And a lot of times, once you understand the whys of something, the what becomes a lot more clear.
Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, and this is not a blanket statement. Please do not come for me. But I think, like, you know, one of the things that I have always felt looking at ceremonial magic looking at witchcraft is ceremonial magic is the human is the top of the pyramid and then God, right? It's like right. all of this serves human and then God.
Right.
And then in witchcraft, it's just more animistic. We're kind of all on the same yeah. level and nothing is really more important. I'm not more important than a spirit and I'm not more important than the oak tree.
Yeah.
Like it is all together.
Well, you know, I mean, even in science, we understand energy is neither created or destroyed. It just mm-hmm. moves.
Yeah.
And I feel like when it comes to witchcraft versus a lot of old school ceremonial magic, and I know a lot of ceremonial magicians who I totally jive with. And I think you'll understand what I'm saying when I say this.
Yeah.
There is a lot more of a relationship of energy moving in witchcraft, which is honestly why I have no issue with the term low magic, because it is not mm-hmm. high. It's not about tons of this interaction with God. It's more about the interaction with the dirt from my crossroads. It's more about mm-hmm. interaction about the stones I find in the river for the river courts, mm-hmm. or the feathers that are left behind me, or I feed the birds. And all of a sudden they're bringing me bamboo leaves from across the street. Like there are acts of real life interaction we make with our tools, our spirits, our spirit allies as animists. And then you can see that in the 13 conjurations, just the same.
Yeah.
You can see that interaction with working with our dead ancestors, with the red inscriptions, working with the offerings of the three flora, working with offering our own life's blood. The power of a witch's blood is a very powerful tool mm-hmm. to work within your magic as an offering, as a life force, working with the cauldron, a birthplace of magic, working with triangles and circles to indicate your specific intentions of malefic or benefic workings. We can see that in this magic a lot more as a relationship for something we're creating, instead of demanding, evoking, and calling upon.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I love that. I love that. So as you know, we
yes.
have our game of chance.
Yes.
And we'll get to that question in just a minute. But
okay.
this is coming out on Hallows Eve, which I'm very excited about.
Me too.
So I want to give you an opportunity to just kind of plug what's coming up for you. You know, where folks can find out more, where they can buy the book, all that good stuff.
Yeah. Hi, I'm Marshall, which is the light. You can find me, of course, on Instagram, Threads, and TikTok at Witch of Southern Light, all one word. My book, The Red Mother, came out on October 1st of this year, 2024. So as of the time of your listening, it's been out 1 month. please buy it. it's on Amazon, in a ebook, a Kindle, a paperback black and white version, or a hardcover color version. I bet you can imagine the color is red. Hopefully soon it will be available on Ingram Spark. If you are a metaphysical store, if you're an occult shop, if you're an independent bookstore and want to carry a self-published author's book on narrative magic, I have two, like I said, Cunning Words and The Red Mother. Cunning Words is already on Ingram Spark. So please, I'd love for you to carry it in your shop. It's a very reasonable price at wholesale. But I want more people to not only read this, but to really get in touch with these stories, to let them touch you in a way that really lights a fire in the heart of your witchcraft. And I think that these stories do that. I am doing a book signing. I almost forgot. I am doing a book signing on November 10th in San Marcos at the Green Heron Bookstore or Bookshop and Solidago. It's a beautiful house with a full-on occult apothecary and magic store, as well as an independent bookstore attached to it. So I will be there from 12 to 4 on November 10th.
Now, make sure there's links for all that in the show notes for folks. And then we're going to play our game of chance. And so I did not remember. I actually went back and listened. So you got sex last time.
Yes.
So I'm going to take that off the table, if that's okay. And then we'll see what we get, what the die tells us. So for folks, for listeners, I'm going to roll this die. And depending on what I get, Marshall will get a question about death, sex, religion, politics, or money, except not sex this time.
No
and
if sex. I
roll a six, Marshall gets to pick.
Okay.
So let's see what the die has to say this time. Three, religion. Interesting.
Okay.
We've touched on this on the topic, not on this question necessarily, but and I'm kind of not sure if this is a religious question or a politics question, but I'm going to ask it here anyway.
Aren't they intertwined anyways?
Right. But I am curious how you, as a witch and as a gay man, I mean, these are not mutually exclusive in your life.
No.
How do you navigate being in the Bible Belt, especially in this fraught time right now? And, you know, like, I think people outside the South who have never lived in the South have this idea that it is like uptight to the nth degree from the coast of Virginia to Texas. And there are pools of progressiveness in that. So I don't want people to think I think that the South is the monolith, because I know it's not. But I did want to ask you, how are you navigating this right now, especially?
First off, that's an amazing question. First off, I do want to say right off of the bat, I want people outside of the South, outside of Texas, outside of Florida, outside of a lot of these Southern states. We are a state of people being held hostage by a, I'll just be political here for a second, by a Republican government. Please understand that so many of our states have been gerrymandered so deeply into a way to disenfranchise the amount of progressive voices here. We are so many. I'm lucky enough to live in a very progressive city in Texas, and I am surrounded by many, many people who are so kind and so, they really are live and let live. A lot of us are.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I did grow up here, so I have a whole lifetime of seeing the different versions of this. And I grew up in what used to be kind of a small town, the suburb of a big city. It was a very conservative town. I was the first guy to ever take another guy to prom in my high school in existence. Wow. I was the first one to ever try to get a gay straight alliance in my high school. I was not the first one to come out. I know that. But at the same time, there was a lot of news and firsts for Coppell. For the place I grew up in. I don't live there anymore, so it doesn't matter. That's true. I don't even live there. There was a lot of firsts for that city that happened with me. And I don't mean that as like, please understand, I'm not trying to say that as a thing that I'm super proud of or happy about. I am proud of some of the things that I was able to expose my community to. But one of the things that I noticed, especially as I got older, there are a lot of really good people here.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, there are a lot of people who live lives as, you know, Bible Belty people, as, you know, good Christian Southerners, who have the best intentions. But unfortunately, there are a lot of communities in the South and Texas where they're afraid to put up their real political opinion signs. Like, I know a lot of clients who come to me as a hairstylist who say, I can't put up that sign in my neighborhood. Mm-hmm. It's not safe. Or not safe, it's going to get stolen. Or yeah. I don't want the ire of all my neighbors
right.
Surrounded by red Trump signs. And as a hairstylist in my city, I'm so lucky to talk to so many of these people, because I'm talking to a lot of conservatives too, and I create a comfortable space for them to sometimes ask me questions. I actually had two different clients this week ask me my thoughts on certain bits of right-wing propaganda that I think mm-hmm. were being pushed by a lot of religious extremists and just infactually incorrect information.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, thank you for asking me that. I'm glad you feel comfortable. And they were like, are you offended? No, I'd love to talk to you about it. And I get the opportunity to share my side of the story.
Mm-hmm.
Some more facts they didn't know about, some statistics that are kind of left out of the thing they're talking about. It is one by one, but it's still one more person than yesterday.
Right.
And I do think that a lot of us in the South are so, so lucky to meet those people along the way. I'm not sitting here saying we're changing minds and changing votes, but you know, people are being more exposed to things they weren't exposed to yesterday, mm-hmm. and they come back.
Yeah. I mean, empathy is born out of familiarity to some
absolutely.
Extent.
Absolutely. There is a level of I'm a humanist at nature. And I do think that the more connections we make as humans, the more we kind of lower that divide.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the more we actually talk to each other about things we're sometimes afraid of, the more we actually learn there wasn't anything to be afraid of that, because you told me something I had no exposure to. I didn't know this before. And yeah. I've spoken to a lot of people in the Bible Belt who find out I'm pagan, or who find out what I write about, who find out about my podcast. And a lot of them are either a lot more curious than I anticipated. Or they might say something like, oh, I have a student. I was a teacher. You know, I have a student who's a Wiccan, and I don't have to correct them that I'm not Wiccan. It's okay.
Yeah.
That's what they know. Or, you know, I have, you know, I've had a lot of parents or aunts or godparents who's like, I think my nephew's gay, or my niece came out as trans, and they're mm-hmm. telling me these things. And I'm talking about thick Southern Texans who've never had the opportunity to talk mm-hmm. to someone else about this before.
Yeah.
And it's so amazing, because I'm seeing their level of empathy as they want to be more educated on a subject, so they can do better going forward, so they can show more respect, so they know, what should I say if? How do I call someone who does what? People are really genuinely curious, and mm-hmm. progress always progresses forward, even if it's inch by inch.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, I love that. I love the idea of creating safe space for people to ask questions, because I do feel like there is, I think people forget that online is not reality.
It's not real. Nothing you see online is real. It may be a report of something happening that's real. It may be an opinion that someone really has. But our one-on-one interactions we have with people on a daily basis are going to sit a lot harder with people. It's going to affect people on a mm-hmm. on a integral level to their opinions, their thoughts about someone. You know, I'm going to be really vague on this, but like, I have a boss who I was really the first gay person they ever got to know. And it really opened their world to who I am as a person mm-hmm. instead of that gay person over there, that person who is gay over there.
Yeah.
They have a completely different understanding of the LGBTQIA community because of a lot of the exposure I've brought to my job. You know, they're very religious people. They always were and they always will be. But there is a new space in their lives. And their, you know, their hearts for people that they didn't know their struggles about before. They mm-hmm. didn't know laws that could get me evicted. They didn't know they could literally have fired me when they hired me because I'm gay. Like, there are so many things that they weren't exposed to until I had the opportunity to share it with them. And we as queer people, as witches, we do this with people in our lives all the time.
Yeah.
And I do think that those interactions are the ones that really actually make a big difference in the world. In the South, we, like I said, we weren't always a bunch of progressive people trapped by trapped here by the GOP. It was a lot more GOP. But we're,
and it's been more progressive at times too. Like,
and it's been more progressive.
I mean, I think about Texas when Ann Richards was governor.
Yeah. There is this web and flow in different directions. Mm-hmm. And personally, I think there is absolutely, it is okay when someone wants to ask me a question for me to feel uncomfortable to do it. I do think there are a lot of people who have been carrying the burden of teaching about themselves to cishet white heteronormative people. Like, we are the ones that do have to carry that burden to educate so they know better.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I cherish that opportunity to share about my culture as a queer person with someone whose entire religion has taught them that I am, that my identity is bad, is a sin. And it really starts to change the way they start to see not only that sin, but the person they always thought was a sinner. All of a sudden they're a person.
Yeah.
And
it's not academic. It's not an idea.
It's not a religious belief. All of a sudden it's, how can I reconcile this thing that I've been born to believe since I was born into a family that's taught me this thing since birth. And now all of a sudden my son is gay. What do I do? What do I do? How do I reconcile with this? And that's something that is becoming super, super pervasive throughout my life, that I've had the opportunity to meet these people, to talk to them, to be an example for someone they now know, you know?
Yeah. Oh, I love that. I love that. And what a great place to end. Marshall, thank you so much. This has been a lovely conversation. I knew it'd be, but it's always lovely to talk to you. And
I'm excited. It's always a pleasure. Thank you. Thank you. There will be more coming. There absolutely will be more books in the future. Like I said, I'm being a little cagey now, but I think, I don't know, sometime maybe after the holidays, sometime in spring, I'm not sure, I might make some sort of announcement or something.
There you go. Well, and just soak in it and enjoy it now. Enjoy that time with the Red Mother now. And then,
absolutely.
And we'll find out later what's coming next.
I will let her be my guide.
Witch Lit is a production of Thousand Volt Press and is edited by Julian Rashke. Our intro music is Cosmic Glow by Andrew Kay, and our outro music is Voices by Alexander Shinekar. Transcripts and all our previous episodes are available at witchlitpod.com, and you can follow us on Instagram at witchlitpod. Please help other witches find us by leaving a rating or review wherever you listen to podcasts. Thank you for listening to and reading Witch Lit.